Oh my word, Jesse's in the car.
Truck.
You gonna make it home in time, or you gonna do the whole thing from there?
What's that?
You gonna do the whole show from there, or are you gonna be home soon?
Yeah, I'm not gonna be home soon, that's for sure.
Oh,
I don't know if you've looked
God.
At the videos on the MetaViews YouTube, but the vast majority are while I'm driving.
Okay.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
All right.
We're back with Access of Easy number 27. I'm Mark Jeftovic in Etobicoke, Charles Hugh Smith from the Big Island in Hawaii, Jesse Hirsch on the road.
On the run. It's like I'm having my OJ moment.
Are you using a web browser on your phone, or do you have the Jitsi client on there?
It's the Jitsi app, yeah.
Good, yeah. That thing's... I mean, I'm really impressed with how much reach Jitsi has across platforms and stuff for an open source initiative, and I'm pretty happy that pretty well anybody can use it. When I send... Not like people who aren't familiar with it, when I set up a meeting and send them a link and say, just go here, and they're like, well, what client do I download? Or, and just don't do anything. Just go there. Just have a webcam on your computer. So I like that.
I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm liking Jesse. I know you're actually in a simulacrum of a moving vehicle, because I've counted the poles and I can see that you just have this video loop behind you. It's
like the old Hanna-Barbera cartoons where the same table and lamp goes by a million times.
Exactly. Or, you know, the 30s noir films where, you know, they're bouncing around in this thing and there's some video behind them, you know, so it doesn't change much.
There's a show up here in Canada called Murdoch Mysteries. All Canadians love it. Good family show. And the thing we do joke about, though, is they have the same extras walking by in the background all the time.
Yeah, occasionally we get to see Murdoch, too. So.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and it's a kind of measurement of your status as a Canadian actor that you had to have had a role on Murdoch Mysteries, or you really have no status because the industry is that small.
What I like about that show is how they weave the historical characters of the day into the episodes. Like, it's an episodic show. It has a few continuing themes, but then, you know, Mark Twain will come through and... my mind's going blank, but... Tesla goes in there. Yeah. Edison. It's a good-natured, fun show. Good for kids.
Yeah, exactly.
So, what do you guys want to talk about this week?
And that's.
Oh, sorry, Charles.
Well, I was hoping. No. I was. I wanted to suggest we pick up whatever threads we didn't get to complete with Ben Hunt. You know, like he had a lot of interesting ideas, and I thought he was able to put them in, you know, language that was like easily digestible, right? I mean, I think that's one of his knacks, and so I'm still fascinated by some of those things we didn't get to completely cover. So if you guys have any feedback that you wanted to pick up from last week's show, I myself keep thinking about, and I wrote about it today, his very simple dictum that if a person is a means to an end, then that's, you know, fake, you know, that's not authentic. And so if that's a pretty easy test. And so when I apply that test to the United States, I get everything is fake.
Well, I had singled out your post today for what to talk about. That's Charles's Everything is Staged post, which we'll put in the show notes. And one of the things I picked up on in that post was when you said democracy is nothing but an elaborate simulacrum of a real-world republic. And what I wanted to pick up on there is I don't think very many people understand what a real-world republic is supposed to be, either in the Platonic sense or in the even forefathers of the U.S. sense. And could you talk a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, I think that's a great topic. And actually, because you are more familiar with Plato's cave than I am, I'd like to hear your, kind of like going back to the roots of what a republic is. I mean, I think...
No, I'm caught out. I'm clueless with Plato's republic. All I've really read was like the cave, and that's all I really know about Plato. And then what we talked about I did 3 semesters at Western way back in the day, and we talked a little bit about it, and I can't remember any of it. So yeah. I'm calling a MacGuffin or whatever.
Well, I think in terms of what we talked about with Ben last week, I would say it's a pretty simple test of a legitimate, authentic republic is a bunch of individuals, each of whom have equal standing before the law, and that each one is recognized as an independent person that has agency and the rights to their own agenda. And so these unique individuals get to sort out what's in their common interest. And that's pretty broad based, but I think that's what I would call an authentic republic. And now it's inauthentic because it's everybody is simply a mark or a con, it's a con to get to close the sale. And in the quote democracy we have now, the sale is the vote, right? So everything is a manipulation. Go ahead, Jesse.
Well, I was going to say part of the controversy of ancient politics, whether Platonic, Aristotelian, Socratic, is it assumed slavery. Right? The right. idea of the citizenry was always a very limited number of people, that right. it wasn't everyone in society. And there was a certain privilege that afforded the leisure time for those citizens or for those members, because the slaves were doing all the work. So that's why they were able to have that. And I think that's actually why it is relevant to America today, because of the nature of the concentration of wealth, because of the reality of there being a sort of leisure class of the super wealthy, and then everyone else is doing the work. The one topic I've been thinking about a lot this week has been antitrust, because this is the week in which the U.S. government has sort of, finally thrown the gauntlet, as it were. I mean, it's really just the start of a longer process, especially if you consider that the antitrust actions against Microsoft took 15 years. And the states are also going to do their own antitrust lawsuits. And, this is just Google. It doesn't include Amazon. It doesn't include Facebook. But I think it does connect with what you guys are raising, both in terms of America as a simulation and the notion of what is a republic, or what role should a government play in restricting a monopoly or fostering competition. So I think this idea of antitrust and the role of antitrust is not only relevant once more, but politically all of a sudden really quite pertinent. Because just as we talk about not so much ideological differences, but the differences between the establishment and the periphery, or the differences between the elite and everybody else, I think those differences are going to manifest in the antitrust debate. I think some of the resolutions or the proposals to address monopoly power are actually going to benefit the elite rather than benefiting the citizens or that ugly thing called consumers. So I'm just kind of curious, as I've been meditating on antitrust, to tie it back into the many threads that we tend to regularly touch upon in this podcast. But finally, I'll offer that because I am in theory multitasking at the moment, perhaps I will participate a little less than usual and rely upon you guys to lead the conversation. But I'm sure I will disagree, as at some point, from a nonverbal and verbal capacity, feel overwhelmed to contribute to the conversation.
Well, it was your article on the antitrust that I picked up from your side for my sort of talking points this week. I loved the line in your article that where there's no difference between Coke and Pepsi if you're in the sugar business. But there was something that you said towards it almost seemed like it was an afterthought at the end of your article, where you said that big tech hosts this is all going to play out in the court of public opinion, but big tech owns the court of public opinion. And I think that was really, obviously material for a separate post and stuff, but overemphasize how important that point is, that we're going to have this, if we're going to have a trial in the court of public opinion, what the boundary of that court is and who controls what goes on in that court. And I just find it so undemocratic, for lack of a better word, I guess, so untransparent, that it really is, it's a problem. And then on Charles's side,
briefly, to your point, it's literally having a hand on the scale of justice.
Yes.
Right? That it guarantees that the casino always wins, that the platform is able to skew the public opinion in their favor, which, and I don't think that it dooms the antitrust measures to fail, but it makes them a whole lot complicated. And I think it's going to make the conversation around this stuff cloudy, to use the most appropriate term.
I think there's, to expand on your point, the winners out of this, there will be no clear winner out of this, and it's certainly not going to be the consumer or the citizen or the netizen. And we used to have a lawyer way back in the early days of EasyDNS, Marshall Margolis, rest in peace. He was a nice guy. He passed away over 10 years ago. He used to always say, we don't want to be the jam in your sandwich. If we got in some embroilment between two gigantic 800-pound gorillas. And I think that's exactly where consumers, citizens, and netizens are today, is they're going to be flour between the grindstones of big tech and big state. And I was looking for a book before we started, the book that was written by Eric Schmidt and the guy from the U.S. State Department. And to me, that almost exemplified, like, this is the private-public partnership toward which we are headed, where the state and big tech at times are in conflict with each other, a very politicized conflict, partisan conflict, and then when they're not in conflict with each other, they actually fuse into each other into a kind of technocratic leviathan, which is not going to be good for anybody. And I still find it all to be lose-lose-lose scenarios, which is a little deflating.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Jesse.
I'll just say one last thing is the dynamics of this antitrust lawsuit against Google is it's the Trump administration sort of making sure that they start this before there's any chance of them being voted out of office. And I think that's significant that this is coming from the Trump administration, given their kind of anti-establishment position. And it puts a lot of pressure on a potential Biden administration to either be seen as being in cahoots with the digital monopoly or feeling some type of pressure to differentiate themselves from the previous regime. So the other point I made in that newsletter post is I kind of wonder if it's become unnecessarily political, that rather than be an issue of economics, it's almost become a partisan issue. And I think that too gets into the whole skewing of the court of public opinion and the way in which this might just be theater rather than something, a simulation rather than the real thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's that I hate how that partisanship or that polarity gets infused into everything. I think it's preventing us from having a sensible response to the coronavirus pandemic. If it infuses, I mean, there was a need for some kind of regulatory action against big tech. And believe me, as a libertarian, it pains me greatly to come out and say that. But if that gets infused with some sort of Republican versus Democrat or left versus right thing, then again, the citizen loses out. That book I was trying to think of the name of was Eric Schmidt and Jared Cohen, The New Digital Age, Reshaping the Future of People, Nations, and Business. And to me, it just kind of read like an early overture to the state on the part of Google to say, like, why don't you just outsource authoritarianism to us and we will take it from here.
Yeah, let me, I'll just kind of come from left field here and say, when I'm listening to you guys discuss the antitrust and the heavy hand on the scale of justice, I'm thinking that the early republics, like say Athens or even the Rome in the Roman Republic, the sort of scenario of a working republic was there was a place, a forum, you know, a physical place you'd go and hear speakers, right? And everyone would more or less have a chance to hear various points of view and even spout off their own. And so what you guys are talking about is instead of that forum being relatively open to differences of opinion, 99% of the people have been swept away and there's only a carefully selected slate of people who talk, right? And that's all we hear. And so that's why we're talking about a simulacrum republic, is who's not getting to say their opinion. And of course, we don't know because that's been black boxed, right? So that's one factor. And another factor I want to bring up real quick is that there was a paper I read recently from anthropologist archaeology kind of perspective, and they were asking a pretty interesting question. They were saying, okay, let's look at 30 different cultures, whether you call them nation states or empires that collapsed. And let's look not at whether they were democratic in the modern sense, like with elections and citizenry and all this kind of stuff, but whether they had institutions that gave the people the same rights that democracy gives, right? And so what they had was recourse to corruption in the elites. You know, in other words, like injustice. Was there some recourse where you could get some sense of justice? And then could you have social mobility, right? Could you rise up in the social and economic sphere? And so it was interesting because it kind of made me realize it's not democracy in and of itself, like just the right to vote, that grants us anything. You know, that, in other words, that's where the simulacrum comes in. It's like, well, just getting to vote doesn't mean that that democracy is functioning. Like, what really matters is, do we have recourse to elite imposed injustices? Do we have social mobility, economic mobility? These are the most basic rights that democracy is supposed to guarantee, if you will, right? And so if it doesn't, then it's a fake democracy. And I think that's really where we're at. We don't have a system of recourse. We have a dual tier society in every way, shape, and form. And so, to Jesse's point, what I fear is that we're having a simulacrum antitrust thing that will drag on inconsequentially for years, and we'll still have the same big tech monopoly. And but then the state functionaries can say, oh, well, we're working on it. We're really going to get those guys someday.
It's like the China trade deal. It was coming real soon now. Real soon, best deal ever, and it was like a non-event when it happened. Two things that have happened to me in the last week about that really hit home on this non-recourse thing. I posted something on Facebook. This really has me wondering if I can even stay on Facebook, but I was pulling stats from World Health Organization, or I was quoting an article that pulled stats from World Health Organization. And I know not everybody agrees with everybody on what's going on with this thing, but they were still stats coming from the WHO, and we posted it. And okay, some people disagree with me and state their objections, and that's all fine. But then the other day I just get this notice in my status bar, and it just says, This is misinformation, it's wrong. And there's this sort of opaque thing that floats over my post now, and it's like, yeah, it's over. And there's not even, like, when Facebook used to say you can't run this ad or something, there was like a little button that said object, and that's not even there. It's just like, no, this is wrong. We looked at it and it's wrong. And the same sort of thing is happening to our business account at Google. We don't do a lot of Google advertising, but we have a couple really micro-targeted campaigns. And suddenly, the ads got suspended because it says malicious content on site. And we're like, okay, what the hell is going on? And we're scanning, and we're just going through everything. We finally got one answer from support that mentioned some domain that we've never heard of and we can't find any trace of. But that's it. Like, they just, it's take it or leave it response. take it or leave it end user license agreements, take it or leave it public squares, take it or leave it terms of service. It's all just take it or leave it. And these entities are so huge. Like, do we as a small business have the luxury to say, well, you know, fuck Google, we're just not going to spend our ad dollars there anymore. And fuck Facebook, we're just not going to put Access of Easy out on Facebook anymore. Do we have that luxury? I would say we don't, because we get so much reach there when Facebook allows it. So there really is this sense of helplessness, this sense of powerlessness that, you know, unless you're a billionaire tech maven, you have absolutely no input into what's going on. And if you are a billionaire tech maven, then whatever you dream up in your infantile mind almost becomes public policy.
Yeah, I disagree. I mean, I agreed with you up to the point in which you were ascribing godlike powers to the billionaire tech maven. Because I would say that while they have a lot of wealth, a lot of privilege, a lot of power, they don't have control. And I don't think that they're actually, even though they're pretending, like it is in their hubris and in their ego, that they're pretending like they have a philosophy that's going to help them deal with this, I think that they're clueless. And I think you're absolutely right in pointing out the tyranny of these systems and the lack of accountability and the lack of appeal. But I don't agree with the hopelessness. I don't agree with the powerlessness. I agree with the frustration. I agree with the injustice. And I think what you're describing is monopoly. That's the point, right? That the antitrust is that Facebook, and I've said this before, that in my community, you don't have the choice of not being on Facebook. Like, so much of the local information, so much of the municipality's information is done via Facebook, which I disagree with. I think that's fucking criminal. But that's the nature of monopoly. And so the reason I say we're not hopeless or powerless is antitrust has a lot of opportunity to really hold these guys accountable. That's why we're lamenting that it's going to be theater. And I want to reiterate something that Mark, that you sort of said as an aside, that when Charles was talking, something Charles said kind of renewed it as a possibility. You know, one terrible scenario would be, imagine antitrust action that simultaneously broke up the digital monopolies and appropriated some of their function into the state.
Yeah.
So the state says, hey, you know, you're doing what we should be doing, so we're going to break you up and appropriate and nationalize part of what you do. So that's why I think this antitrust debate is so essential, because it really is powerful and it speaks to power we have in a democracy or in a fraudocracy or whatever it is we live in. We nonetheless have power over these companies that we ought to be exercising. So that's why I think we have to disavow ourselves of the idea that we're hopeless or powerless. What we are is frustrated and pissed off. What we are is dissatisfied and upset with the lack of accountability, the lack of transparency, and the sheer tyranny and authoritarianism of these platforms. But I also don't think that we should mythologize those platforms, because they are clueless. They have no power. They have no competence. You know, the incident with Twitter and that New York Post article in which they were first censoring the article under the very legitimate argument that it contained personal information rather than censoring the argument in it. And then they reversed it because they realized that that's not how it was being perceived, that it was like, it was a clown show, right? It was total incompetence. Twitter has no clue what they're doing. Facebook has no clue what they're doing. These guys would benefit from making their systems more accountable and allowing appeals and creating a type of governance structure that was at least comparable to a republic, if not a democracy. And the fact that they're not doing that is going to hurt their bottom line. It's going to hurt their business. And that's where they need to have a moment of humility and really try to come out of this and be like, you know, yeah, we need your help. Hey, everybody, help us with all this content. Help us with all this nonsense, because we can't do it on our own. Rather than the simulation, rather than the false boasting, where they are acting like they can fix it on their own, and we all know they can't.
I have to jump in quickly, Charles, because I would be derelict if I didn't point out Bill Ottman, Minds.com, who I had on, I think it was just a solo, myself and him, that Minds is trying almost, they're probably in my mind the closest to that Republic system, where they have a peer-based review of content with an appeals process built in. So it's actually like a jury system with an appeal. And I don't know any other tech platform that's doing it or even attempting to do it that way. I don't know if it would scale. I don't know if it can't be gamed, but I have to mention that there at least is one other tech company out there that's attempting to do it this way, and that Minds is open sourced. So even if you had a community or a grassroots movement that said, these are the principles upon which we want to base our discourse in our public square, but you don't want to be on Minds, you can just download the code base off of GitHub and spin up your own community, and you would have that appeals process built in and that review process built in. I've actually thought of Minds, like the Minds code base, as the central, not a central node, but like the core base node of a network of systems that could go into Climb. I've been thinking about this lately and kind of mapped it all out and said, you would use Minds, right? And each community would sort of start there. But I'm getting way out in the weeds now, but I did want to mention that.
Yeah, no, I don't think you're out in the weeds at all. I think those kind of models are where we need to be going. And, you know, I wrote a post, I think it was maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago, in which I proposed that the big social media platforms should be essentially expropriated, nationalized, but in the form of a the water board. Yeah, yeah. Let me make the argument here. Is, you know, everybody talks about, well, we need to privatize everything, right? And that was the whole neoliberal scam. And so what happened when towns got sold this neoliberal con game of, oh, let's sell our water service, right? Which was municipally owned, and it was run by an elected board, right? So it was actually a community owned, democratically organized utility, right? And that works, right? Because if you feel like it's being mismanaged, you replace the board through your next election, right? And so on. Well, you know, what about that model? You know, and I think I would love to, and I know this sounds completely against Mark's philosophy, but I would say let's expropriate all these social media platforms and run them on a utility model, you know, and which is actually community owned and, you know, well, democratically run.
I will point at a Canadian company here called Two Cows, which is Jesse would know them. Unfortunately, Jesse would do to benefit from them, but they don't do this in Canada. They only do this in the US. But they make deals with municipalities, with communities, and they go in and they become like the broadband utility of a community in a municipality. And the way that my understanding is it's sort of as you would describe that, Charles. So this is a community utility, and what the community does is they grant a long-term contract to Two Cows, who's then gonna come in, they're gonna trench everything, lay all the fiber, they spend the money to build it, and then they say, okay, but now we've got this 25-year or 30-year annuity to run broadband in this town, but it's the town's broadband, I think, as far as I understand it. So, you know, that's kind of like a private-public partnership that might not be malevolent and corrupt. I could be biased because I know a lot of people at Two Cows. They've been across the street from EasyDNS for decades. There's kind of a revolving door between the two companies. But it just seems like, yeah, this doesn't seem bad to me. It seems okay. I don't know if you've heard about this in the States, Charles and Jesse. I don't know how much you've been following the broadband telecom legislative review process up here, which to me seems like that kind of a policy move on the part of the government to sort of justify this sort of wholesale, I won't say expropriation yet, it's just more of a control over the broadband internet infrastructure in Canada, it's really a really bad set of 97 recommendations. They're all terrible.
You continue to give wind to something that the government is not in any way interested in.
I don't know
and
about that.
No, that's my point. You don't know.
But this
hold on. One thing you're getting wrong is this isn't the government who did it. It's an external body who did the review. It's not the government. They gave recommendations to the government, and the government has given zero indication of any interest in any of those recommendations.
The new Stephen...
It doesn't mean to your point that they're not going to do it. They could. But I'm just pointing out, it wasn't the government that made those recommendations. It was a party independent of government.
But they commissioned the study.
Commissions a lot of stuff, much of which contradicts itself.
And then since then, they've taken from those recommendations, as like they've never even said the word BTLR. The latest Stephen Guilbeault idea around forcing the tech companies to pay the media companies licensing fees for linking, that is straight out of the BTLR. They've maybe never said that, but that's
again,
it's like in there.
You're being thoroughly paranoid and really helping to diverge the conversation from the subject we normally talk about. The idea of paying for linking predates the BTLR. It's a policy idea that's being debated globally. And the fact that the BTLR mentioned it, that's how policy discussion works. I still feel that you are giving far more weight to the BTLR than it deserves, and you're giving more credibility to the BTLR than anyone else in the country. So if you actually don't like it, then I encourage you to forget about it, and everyone else will too.
Are you saying that I'm like invoking Streisand effect around this thing?
Very much so.
Well, let me jump in here. you know, we all know there's trial balloons. That's part of the simulacrum and the staging effect is trial balloons are set off by various authorities to see how the public reacts or doesn't react. So there's that too. I just wanted to mention this whole thing, Jesse, you mentioned global, you know, that there's global policy debates and so on. And the antitrust thing, I have very low faith actually in the U.S. because of all these things we're talking about. But the big tech companies could be brought to heel by the EU, because the EU is actually more aggressive in I think, antitrust than the U.S. But there's such a big market that the big tech would have to do it globally. They can't really break their system up into two systems. And in fact, even if the state of California broke their backs, and the Supreme Court just let it ride, that would break their backs too, you know, because they can't really have multiple markets and multiple policies for. So anyways, that's hopeful, because if somebody large enough comes in and breaks their back, then they'll have to do it even in North America.
And that was a very important perspective that Attorney General Barr and the Trump administration had in enacting this antitrust action, is they correctly identified that Europe has a huge head start when it comes to making the rules for the digital marketplace. And themselves didn't at the very least enter the debate, let alone come up with their own regulations, their own rules, that they're basically abdicating to Europe, that they're abdicating responsibility, that they're abdicating the way in which these rules are made. And I thought that that was a very important, if not potentially humble, admission on behalf of the Trump administration that reinforces that regulation isn't always bad, that in many cases it's about who comes up with the best rules. And if you sit out, if you don't participate at all, that means someone else is making up the rule. So there's a real incentive to at least get in the game. And, you know, Mark, part of why I get critical of you in terms of the BTLR is I think part of the trap of politics, and in particular of American politics, is when it sort of lazily falls into the culture of opposition rather than the culture of solution. In that I think we, as the three of us, but also politics in general is best when it focuses on the things that you want, when it focuses on the things that you're in favor of. But when you focus on the things that you're opposed to, when you sort of put your attention towards the things that you're opposed to, you're not only strengthening your opposition, you're not only strengthening that which you oppose, but you're denying yourself the opportunity to talk about what you're in favor of. Because I think that that is, going back to conversations we had in earlier episodes, that's the opportunity of alternatives. That's the opportunity to create, whether it's alternative infrastructure, whether it's our whole point about protocols over platforms. It's the way in which that positive attention is focused that I think has the greatest opportunity for plurality, or the greatest opportunity for social change, because we should be taking attention away from the establishment, away from the dysfunctional institution, and putting that attention into the types of structures and environments that, that we would like to see flourish.
I guess that's more towards, we should be focusing on what we called the great opt-out in previous episodes of just like, okay, so if this is not working, what do we want then? I tend to glom on to the negative. I've been accused of being pessimistic and paranoid by more than the likes of you guys, but
My watchword is to take former Intel president
Andy Grove.
Andy Grove, thank you. Yeah, only the paranoid survive. And of course, he was speaking about businesses that, that get rest on their laurels, right? And but I think it's there's a healthy paranoia that I ascribe to, but so there's a healthy and unhealthy paranoia. We're in a healthy paranoia camp here. You know, I want to mention one more thing about that paper because I think it's relevant here. And picking up on what Mark said earlier about the potential union of the state and big tech, right? That's what we would fear most, right? And and Eric Schmidt helpfully laid out the whole, you know, blueprint for that. One of the points in this paper I referenced earlier, and Mark, I'll send you the link, was in a functioning government where people do have recourse and they have social mobility, a key element is that the elites devote a tremendous amount of attention to the public good, right? And so if you look at pretty much any of these empires that lasted hundreds of years, there was always a public good, right? I mean, there was either water supplies and food, you know, granary storage against drought, et cetera, et cetera. And so when the elites get so self-absorbed and narcissistic that they're only interested in infighting and grabbing as much as they can, then of course the legitimacy of the state is lost and collapse ensues. And so their point, actually, their concluding point was that this moral decay of the elites leads to what they called a hard collapse, not just like a sort of temporary or modest collapse, but a complete, total, systemic collapse when you get the moral collapse of the elites. And so, you know, to Mark's point about the state and big tech, I think we could, from a very long point of view, look at this antitrust action as, is the state capable of acting in the public good, or has that been completely lost? And if it's been completely lost and big tech wins, then in a way you can say collapse is guaranteed.
Well, and that's where, to go back to my point about like the focus on attention, that's where I think antitrust should be framed as an opportunity. Like a win-win proposition, in that the appropriate antitrust regulation will actually empower the tech platform because it'll address the issues of trust and credibility, and it can help them with their governance issues when it comes to dealing with issues like content or issues like disputes. And similarly, it can help society in creating these rules and creating protections for citizens that could actually help empower a democratic society. And similarly, and this is where I think you raise a very powerful point, Charles, whether this could help the state, whether this could return credibility and trust and moral effectiveness to the state. I am skeptical, as you are, but at the same time, it could be seen as an opportunity to avoid that hard collapse. Because on the one hand, I think what the three of us sort of share is an indictment of the elite that the power needs to be removed from power, or their power needs to be neutralized. So even if they're not removed, their ability to use that power is greatly diminished. And yet at the same time, a new elite, a digital monopolist elite, kind of taking place, and maybe that's where antitrust regulation ends up helping us to kill those two birds with the same stone, or perhaps a little more accurately, to neutralize or ground those two birds or clip those two birds with the same stone, in that in rallying people via antitrust to oppose or be critical of the digital monopolies, there's an opportunity to do so with the state, to say, we fear the power that these digital monopolies have, but we also don't want the state to have that same power in reverse. And so in advancing the narrative of antitrust, in advancing the proposal of antitrust, maybe we could advance this larger narrative of decentralization, of transparency, citizen accountability.
I think he muted his mic, so I think that means he's done talking, because you really broke up towards the end there. We kind of lost your sound.
I'm getting further and further into the sticks.
Right.
So all of this to me is an interesting experiment as to whether this road connection is better than my home connection. But now is where it may start to deteriorate as I get further into the wilderness.
Well, I love your point about I love your point about this and being an opportunity, right? And that the state could regain some of its credibility, and at the same time, big tech could or the digital monopolies could gain by having common sense regulatory structure that they could then say, well, we're complying, you know, and that would be much easier for them than trying to make it up on the fly.
What I worry about, and it was something the way you phrased that, Jesse, near the beginning of that last bit you were talking about, that it sent my antenna up, because I thought all of this is going to create a greater regulatory burden, and higher regulatory burdens reduce competition. They don't expand competition. And Charles, I told you this story once before, way back, I think, on our second ever podcast that we did for your audiobooks. But I was, in the early days of Bitcoin, I was interested in talking to, like, finding out in the fins, you know, in the financial ecosystem what was going on. And some people from the business development bank set up a meeting with me downtown at one of the big four banks, and they had an entrepreneur in residence who was a lawyer, and they were very great, took time to sit down and meet with me. And this entrepreneur in residence lawyer was the one who did most of the talking, but we were just talking about, like, this, what did this wild, wild west of the cryptocurrency landscape look like. And he told me the story of, you know, Mark, what you want to do is you want to get some big funding behind you, and you want to work with the regulators to get all of this regulation passed. And he came out and he said it, regulation keeps your smaller competitors out. And what you want to do is you want to be part of the regulatory solution. You want to be the first people in the door. And when it's done, when the regulatory environment is finished, you get to turn around and pull the ladder up behind you. That was the exact words he used. I never forgot that. And I thought, this is how it works. And that's what I worry about is going to be the outcome of all of this antitrust in any country, will be Facebook and Google and Twitter and Amazon get to pull the ladder up behind them.
And I think that's my point to you, that this is your opportunity to imagine and articulate what you think the antitrust response could be. Because it doesn't have to involve regulatory burden or additional regulation. One of the more viable antitrust actions is just sheer breakup, right? It just says, you know, these are multiple companies disguised as a single company. The market would be far more competitive if we just broke them up. And then the rule might be, you know, you're not allowed to have these functions in the same company. If you're an innovative company, you'll just keep spinning off companies. You'll just be creating new competition. And that's why antitrust, I think, is such a potentially fascinating policy area, because it not only includes regulatory law, it includes competitive law. So you can have a libertarian approach to antitrust, which seeks to remove regulation and increase competition by creating rules that are easily enforced, but spell out very clearly where you will not tolerate either consolidation, anti-competitive practices, or collusion, which is often what happens in a monopoly sense, the way that Google internally colludes to make sure that its own products appear at the top of search engines, and so on and so forth. So that's where, Mark, I'd be curious in the next week or two to kind of read in Access of Easy what you think a libertarian antitrust response would be, because this is my point of when you talk about what you're in favor of, that's where you usually have me on side, right? When you talk about, you know, companies shouldn't be bailed out, when they fail, let them fail, I'm like, yeah, exactly. And that's pretty close to an antitrust policy. So that's what I'm saying. I'd be curious to have you kind of use your imagination to come up with what you think is an antitrust policy that either stays true to libertarian principles, or at least aspires to libertarian principles, and acknowledges the 800-pound gorillas in the room, which are the digital monopolies, which we all agree need to be stopped before they become, you know, the digital empires or the digital tyrants or the digital authoritarians.
Let me just ask a question there. From past history, and it's a question, not a statement of any sort. Didn't the phone companies, Charles, maybe you would know better, in the States just kind of slowly coagulate back together after they were broken up?
They did.
Yeah, they did. And so that's one example of how it can go. But, you know, I wanted to mention a response to Mark, your point about the ladder being pulled up. I think this is the corrupt state of affairs we live in. I mean, this is the reality that people use regulation, right, to further their monopoly position in effect by either setting up a quasi, you know, monopoly because the barriers to entry are so high no one can possibly do it, or a quasi cartel, right, where the insiders all have the same product and charge the same price and have a more or less an annuity. And regulation is actually a thicket that no one can get through because it's 7,000 pages of regulation and so on and so forth. So, and again, we can say, why would this happen? And you go, well, it's the elites are acting in their self-interest, not the public good or the common good, right? And that's really the core. It really boils down to like a moral kind of situation. And so what Jesse is proposing is, there's an opportunity for an actual moral resurgence in which the common good or the public good takes precedence above self-interested greed. And the question is, do we have institutions which are capable of this? And I'm not so sure anymore. I think that the corruption is now so deep, so systemic, I hesitate to even hope for a moral resurgence that could put the public good above self-interested greed.
I'm highly skeptical
I technically would agree with you. I would point out that the nature of the internet means that there is an institution that transcends all, and that is the internet itself, right? That there is a
We're losing them.
And we see it a lot, right? It happens. It happens every time that people get pissed off and rebel against these platforms. So while I hear you, Charles, I think about kind of moral, and I think we shouldn't underestimate that all it takes is popular will.
The gist of what you said is we shouldn't underestimate that all it takes is popular will, and that you are more optimistic than Charles and myself because we have an institution in itself being the internet. Your signal really broke up very badly, so I'm almost thinking we should call for closing remarks at this point because I think you're getting into a nether zone of poor audio quality that may just render you inaudible.
Yeah, well, you know, Mark, I think that, thank you for summarizing Jesse's comments, and I am hopeful that there is an opportunity. Antitrust has a long history of breaking up extremely powerful private monopolies, so that might work. And then Jesse, just to let you know, your video's frozen, so I think we might have lost you, but I am willing to be hopeful with antitrust, because it does have a long history, and we could be surprised. And the thing I would like to see is a limit on the sale of data. If you limited the sale of data, you would cut the big tech monopolies off at the knees. And that would be something I would be very hopeful and would be wanting to write about, to say, this is what we need to do, you know?
The libertarian in me would say, you own your data. Whatever data you produce, you own. And what a sort of philosophy or body of work that embodies that without calling itself libertarian is Doc Searle's Intention Economy Vendor Relations Management, who I have not heard back from, but I will continue to try and get him on the show because I think he would be great. And while we have signal from Jesse, I would like to ask you, you quoted Matt Stoller in your last article, and I have his book, Goliath, 100 Years of Antitrust. I have not read it. Have you?
No, but I read his newsletter, which is fantastic. Although yeah, I don't agree with everything he says.
Yeah.
But his research is fascinating.
Yeah, he's good.
And let me point out that part of what I was trying to do today is illustrate the political economy of communication. That the further I got from civilization, the harder it was for me to participate. And I think that is the nature of the challenge we face moving forward, that we take for granted how technology deteriorates the further we get away from the centers of power.
Excellent metaphor. Good place to close, I think. All right. That was Access of Easy number 27, and we will see you guys next week.
All right. Thank you.